Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm really happy. Kathleen Shine, that's S-C-H-I-N-E, is my guest, and I just inadvertently said, my job is to help you shine. And her new book is The Grammarians. And years ago, when I used to talk to Pauline Kael on the phone regularly, she recommended your first novel to me, Alice in Bed, and I've read you ever since. How many books is it now?
This is 11.
This book is called The Grammarians, and it's about identical twins who grow up and they share, as a certain twins do, a private language, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you made it up.
I did. I had hoped to make up an entire language, but that's rather difficult. So I referred to the Mitford's language a lot. And
the Mitford's language? Yeah, the Mitford sisters?
The Mitford sisters.
They had a private language.
They had a private language, which all of them spoke to each other. So I tried to use some of that. But finally, I ended up just inventing just a couple of words.
It's a pleasure. It's a delicious book. It's very funny. And what a joy. By the end, it's, in addition, profound. Because we've been, during the duration of this book, watching these two children, Laurel and Daphne, growing up. Their mother has always felt a little bit outside the great closeness of these two children. But by the end of the book, we enter her private realm. And it's a beautiful chapter that I think takes the book outside of the somewhat novel arena it's been occupying into the human heart. And these two sleep in, of course, twin beds, and they have the inevitable matching sweater sets, and they begin by holding hands from one twin bed to the other, but before very long, the parents come into the bedroom to find them inevitably asleep in the same bed. The first step in individualization is that the one who's 17 minutes older, do I have that right?
That's right.
Says, I want to sleep in my own bed tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's going to start a revolution because it's very hard for people who've been confused with one another since birth to make any moves. And this is a Jewish family, and the older of two girls has a nose job. And it's regarded not as the altering of a religious marker. It's regarded by the younger sister
as a betrayal.
As a betrayal.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, a lot of, I hesitated at first to write about twins because I couldn't imagine what that was like. But then I realized there's something very profound about that. There has to be about that connection and how people can be alike, truly alike, and also individuals. And that's very much something that we all feel, in, but in different ways. And the kind of coming together of people, of siblings, or splitting apart, of families together, but also trying, you know, being a unit, but also trying to differentiate yourself from the other people in the family, and even of in romance. And so the twins started to, the idea of it became really very insistent. And the twins themselves became very insistent that that's who I write about.
These are language-loving sisters.
Yes.
And one of their inductions into the world of loving language is listening to the cast album of My Fair Lady.
Yes.
And it's said about them that the two of them are miniature Henry Higginses. Eliza has a song called Without You, and she says, music will thrive without you. Somehow Keats will survive without you. And the mother is very pleased that her daughters have no idea who Keats is.
She asks them, and they say, he's in the song. Why are you asking us this stupid question? but, you know, she's a little bit frightened by them and their closeness, and feels a little excluded and is baffled by them. So she's very relieved that they're a little bit normal and don't know who Keats is.
And their uncle, who's a psychiatrist, is afraid of them, too. Mm-hmm. And their cousin, who's a little bit obnoxious.
Brian
is afraid of them, too. And you see, one of their bonds, and what little smart kid hasn't done this, is to learn words that other people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
To keep a notebook full of such words, which they claim that they like because of their sounds.
Mm-hmm.
What is the word they find that means underarms?
Oxter, I think. Is that right? I'm not sure.
I think it's Oxter.
Yeah.
But I'd never heard it before.
I had never heard. I found it in, I was reading a mystery written, oh, I can't remember the guy's name, but, you know, I read a lot of books written in the, before the First World War. And I think I saw that there. And I just saw it in a tweet, actually. It was a quote. Something about the Parliament and Brexit and everything. And there it was. It was so exciting because I didn't know it. People still or ever really used it.
I didn't know it. And I thought, great, a synonym for underarms.
Yes.
This is what I read novels for. But Kathleen Shine, my guest, who is the author of The Grammarians, which is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, has stocked the book like a pond with little language surprises for her young protagonists to share, mm-hmm, and eventually to use against one another. Because one of them, growing up, becomes one of those people who has a prize-winning column on the use of language and the misuse of language.
Right.
And the other becomes a poet.
Right.
And she appropriates, as they say, language used from the parents of soldiers during World War I who are in mourning. So the two sisters have grown apart, although they have remained literary people. Can there be personal wars fiercer than literary wars?
I don't think so. And I love the idea, again, of them being joined still by this passion for language, but within that, separated by their different needs from the language. And one is for a kind of order and aesthetic dignity, and the other is for freedom and experimentation and rhythm and just sound. So that was where the book started, even before the twins came along. I wanted to write about words. I was very depressed from all the political stuff, and I just wanted to write about something that I just loved without measure, and that's language. And so that's where it started. I wanted to cheer myself up.
Well, I think it may be true that we'll be seeing novels that start to be about language again, because who among readers and writers, who is not at least overwhelmed by the political stuff? And we need language to save us. We need language, the careful, extravagant, bonanza use of language.
And also at a time like this, I think the misuse of language becomes dangerous. And so, you know, you don't want an unexamined life and you don't want an unexamined sentence.
You have two sons, yes?
Yes.
And one of them has just graduated college?
He has. No, he just
graduate
got a PhD
wow.
in linguistics.
This must have made you so proud.
Oh, I was very happy because I'm a word nerd. And so there was someone I could say, look, did you see this on Language Hat, this blog that I like? And he's interested in a very different kind of language. He's interested in phonology and sounds and computer things, but still it was someone someone who wouldn't just roll their eyes at me. My kids didn't read. They were not readers as children, and they still don't read my books. So,
isn't that to keep themselves safe?
I think so. I think it's wise. This book, I think, is safe.
They could read and enjoy, especially because it's twin sisters.
Right.
And they're Daphne and Laurel, and they are versions of one another until they're not.
Yes.
You know, and when they're not, this feels like betrayal.
Yes.
On both sides.
Yes.
One has betrayed the other by getting a nose job, but by the time they're finished, betrayal is almost weekly, and we learn in the first pages of the book that these grown-up sisters have not heard from one another in years.
Yes, yes. And this was a little bit inspired by Ann Landers and Dear Abby, who were twins, identical twins, one of whom got a nose job and had a long feud, many years. And it was professional jealousy, I think, that precipitated that. But at one point I had thought of writing about columnists like Dear Abby. And I thought, no, I don't like those kind of columns. I want to write about words.
Now, to what extent, when you read novels, are the books you love about words?
Well, I think they always are to some extent because, you know, you're responding to the way a writer has decided to organize words and to make patterns with words. So they always are. And I think when they're too self-consciously about words, that can interfere with your reading and with the experience of the book. If a book is too self-consciously written as look how beautifully I write, I think that can be a problem for me anyway. But a book that its topic is words, I don't really know of much fiction that is overtly about that. I mean, I read a lot of wonderful nonfiction about dictionaries and about grammar, but I haven't, I don't, do you know of any that I should be reading?
To my mind, right, when I started coming head over heels about reading, it was in college, it was literary modernism, it was James Joyce, and eventually all that work is about words, especially Finnegan's Wake, which may be the only book in the language in which practically no word is not a typo. He misspelled everything in order to find its hidden meanings. And people don't read Finnegan's Wake anymore.
I have not read it, and I have been told by many people to read it. But if you're telling me to read it, I'm going to read it.
Well, Kathleen,
don't tell anyone I haven't read it.
No, I promise not to. Your secret is safe with all of us.
Good.
I'm going to confess something to you.
Okay.
For many, many years, people told me how much they enjoyed reading Ulysses. And I have to tell you, I didn't enjoy it. I attended classes in college when we spent weeks and weeks and weeks reading it. It wasn't like I shirked my responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I had all the guidebooks, a reader's guide to James Joyce, Joseph Campbell's guide to James Joyce, a skeleton key to James Joyce, a book called Joyce's Voices.
Joyce's Voices.
Honest. I read a book about the censorship of Ulysses. I thought, yeah, why was Ulysses censored? It's so hard to read. Who would know what to censor? And I decided I would read it. And I would read it unassisted. My lovely, incredibly benign sponsors sponsored on Irish radio a complete reading of Ulysses with more than 100 actors. So I'd listen to the chapter read by actors who had the Irish accent and who knew the songs and how they would be sung. And then at night I'd read the chapter, and I read Ulysses in 2 to 3 weeks, and I loved it. I thought it couldn't be so. I thought, oh no, this is, you know, one of those difficult books don't really like. But I loved it, and it changed my life.
Well, I think I may have to follow your example.
Give it a whirl.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want, I'll even lend you my recordings.
Yes. Thank you.
Kathleen Shine, though, is the author of books, The Goddess at the Riverhead of the Kathleen Shine novel is Jane Austen. They are novels of sensibility, largely about families, and they're about the destructive ways in which people try to make one another happy.
That's true.
Are you a fan of Jane Austen? I've never asked you.
Yes. If you write novels, I think it would be very difficult not to be a fan. You know, my last book was so intensely about families and people being ill, and it felt very personal. This book, which is about words as well as a family, is in some ways the most personal book I've ever written.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Kathleen Shine about her new novel, The Grammarians. Now, listen. Would you consider upgrading your membership? Do it. You know why? Making an additional donation during the UnDrive pledge drive allows us to really know we can count on our listeners, and we have to. That's the way KCRW runs. Help us and do it today. Go to kcrw.com and join or call 800-600-KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. And I'm talking with Kathleen Shine about her new novel, The Grammarians, in which sisterly and linguistic manners create a scrumptious landscape of turmoil in twinship. And it has, as its invisible point of demarcation, the differences between Webster's second and third international dictionary.
Right. Right.
This is the world in which the dictionary registered propriety, what was right, what was proper, what was formal, what had been said and done, to the dictionary, which contains famously the word ain't.
Yes. And has words, it has slang in it that it doesn't designate as lesser than. There's a wonderful book about Webster's dictionary, about the Merriam-Webster by Corey Stamper, that is a lot about how dictionaries work that I loved. But I also read this book called The Story of Ain't, which was about the switch from one dictionary to the other and the tremendous controversy. I mean, it was a revolution.
What are those words, 60s. Prescriptive and descriptive? Is that what?
Yes, those are linguistic words. And one is really for kind of old-fashioned grammarians. And
what should be? It's a prescription.
Right, it's a prescription. Or as I was talking about this to Roy Blunt, who's a very old friend, the other day, and he said, "Well, I don't like prescriptions. I like my words over the counter." So, but the prescriptivist, yes, it's what should be. There are these rules, and they must be followed. That's the exaggerated version of it. And descriptivists say, we are here to look at language to try to describe what it is. We're here to describe it and not to make rules about what should and shouldn't be. And so for a writer, I sort of balk at this idea of there isn't something that's right, because I can hear when something's right or wrong. But I also balk at this idea of there are these rules that must not be broken, because there are many times when the rules make things worse. So I took that kind of civil war and gave it to these two girls, and it turned out to be very interesting where that led them and where that led me.
One grows up to be a prescriptive grammarian writing a column called, what was it called?
The People's Pedant.
The People's Pedant, right. And the other writes a kind of poetry in which she reverses time and mm-hmm. moves back to World War I to open the door of her poetry to the slang of grief that parents expressed as their children went off to die. And they are twins, and they have moved over time to opposing uses of language, and yet in many ways they're still the same people.
Yes.
You see, this book is about so many things. It's about twins, and it's about families. It's about love. It's about
yes.
poetry. It's about language. But in particular, it seems to me, don't stick out your tongue at me, you promise?
I promise.
It seems to me to be about love.
I agree. I am not sticking my tongue out at you.
After my parents both died, my sister and I became still better friends.
Mm-hmm.
And because as our mother was dying, we spoke to her on the phone every day, my sister's daughter, a school psychiatrist, said to us, why don't you talk to each other every day at the time you used to talk to what was for her grandma?
Uh-huh.
And we do. But that love is what this book is about.
I had this realization, which is that pop music and opera and literature and all art is so much about needing someone and wanting to be independent. It's about the push and the pull, and requiring a tremendous intimacy, and or the other person needing to be farther away, wanting them back, or wanting to get away. And that movement, that dynamic, I think is very much what this book is about. Because it's about two individuals who had to elbow for room in the womb and still, you know, still do in the kind of bigger womb of the world.
Well, what I love about this particular book is that it's so funny.
Oh, thank you.
You know, it sounds like we've been talking about, you know, head-scratching subject matter, but in fact, the book is hilarious, and I wondered if you can talk about writing a comic novel about serious things.
Well, you know, I don't know how to talk about that because it's the only way I know how to write anything. So I very much wanted this book to be funny. I needed some laughter. And you know, making puns and fooling around. And the girls became funnier. And I really started to like them because they were, you know, quite mischievous and funny in the way they treat other people. When they're teasing their uncle, and even when they're talking about each other, when they're angry at each other. And that became, for me, a lot of the texture of the book. And then through that comes the heart and the soul of the book. The more serious parts of it have to, you know, it is sort of comes out of that. But I don't know of a technique or how to, you know, how to measure it. It's just the only way I know how to write anything or even get through the day, really.
I've been talking with Kathleen Schein, the author of The Grammarians. It's published by the imprint Sarah Crichton Books at Farrar, Straus and Giroux. It has enjoyed one of a writer's dreams, especially a novelist, is to be reviewed on the front cover, reviewed well, reviewed positively on the front cover of the New York Times Book Review. The Grammarians was reviewed very positively on the front cover of the New York Times Book Review. Congratulations, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available, well, at Apple, Spotify, all podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Don't forget, that's Kathleen, S-C-H-I-N-E, the author of The Grammarians. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I think that's a wonderful interview, one that's only possible thanks to the support of our listeners. If you've discovered an author on Bookworm, or found a challenging narrative you love, or rekindled a lost love for one of the books we've featured, please support it. The revolutionary UnDrive means no lost programming. You make it possible. Join now by going to kcrw.com/join.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.